Good morning, and welcome to a Sunday morning at the United Lodge of Theosophists. We will begin with a reading of the Declaration. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So welcome to Philadelphia. Here in Philadelphia, we carry out the work of the lodge by holding meetings typically twice per week on a Sunday morning. The doors open at 10:30, and the meeting is from 11 to 12. This year, during the summer, we're studying a small treatise or a small tract, The Epitome of Theosophy, authored by one of the co-founders, William Q. Judge. And for your information, our summer meetings are on Sundays, July, and September. So going through August, we don't have Sunday meetings. The doors open at 10:30, and the way that this meeting is held, at least today, is we're going to have the part read by several students, and in between each part, we're going to take a moment and either reflect or discuss or ask a question about that part. It's a pretty long, kind of deep part, and so breaking it up helps us perhaps digest it a little better. That being said, that's Sundays during the summer. Wednesday evenings, we also have a class going on in the Bhagavad Gita. The doors open actually at 5:15 because we have a reference library available for study, and that's from 5:15 to 7:15. Then from 7:30 to 8:30 is the group study in the Bhagavad Gita, which is comprised of a reading, and also most of the hour, discussion, questions, back and forth. That's the nature of the meeting, is to engage and contribute. There, of course, is a book table in the foyer, which makes available all the straight-line theosophical literature, books, pamphlets, and magazines, available to the public at cost to the lodge. And also, though, if you care to look it up online, talk to the person at the book table, we'll give you the right website to go to where it's searchable, downloadable, and everything is free online. But if you're the kind that likes to have the book so you can scribble in it, we have that too. The lodge here is open to the public. It's open to everybody, free and open to the public. All are welcome. There's no charge for anything, and everybody who does anything here, any of the presentations, everybody's a volunteer. We're all student volunteers. Nobody's paid a dime to do anything here. And that being the case, keeping this building going, certainly the Lodge welcomes any contributions in terms of time and effort, service or money. Anything is certainly gratefully received. So without further ado, we will begin our class. It begins on page 18. And the first reading, well, we'll just have the first reading and then we'll take a minute or two and open the floor for discussion. Please.
Okay.
Oh, page 18 starts with Theosophy Also Teaches.
Yes. The Astral Light. Theosophy also teaches the existence of a universal, diffuse, and highly ethereal medium, which has been called the Astral Light and Akasa. It is the repository of all past, present, and future events, and in it are recorded the effects of spiritual causes and all the acts and thoughts from the direction of either spirit or matter. It may be called the Book of the Recording Angel. Akasa, however, is a misnomer when it is confused with ether, or the astral light of the Kabbalist. The Akasa is the noumena, or the cause, of the phenomenal ether, or astral light proper. For Akasa is infinite, impartite, intangible, its only production being sound. And this astral light is material and not spirit. It is, in fact, the lower principle of that cosmic body of which Akasa is the highest. It has the power of retaining all images. This includes a statement that each thought, as well as word and act, makes an image there. These images may be said to have two lives. First, their own is an image, and second, the impress left by them in the matrix of the astral light. In the upper realm of this light, there is no such thing as space or time in the human sense. All future events are the thoughts and acts of men. These are the producers in advance of the picture of the event which is to occur. Ordinary men continually, recklessly, and wickedly are making these events sure to come to pass, but the sages, the Mahatmas, and the adepts of the good law make only such pictures as are in accordance with divine law, because they control the production of their thought. In the astral light are all the differentiated sounds as well. The elementals are energetic centers in it. The shades of departed human beings and animals are also there. Hence, any seer or entranced person can see in it all that anyone has done or said, as well as that which has happened to anyone with whom he is connected.
Well, there's a lot to digest there. Any insights to this? Yes.
So, this is how psychics that perform before an audience can pick up all these details. Sometimes they have a ringer in there too, often, who's asked people questions ahead of time. But through this astral, even if they can only have a rudimentary grasp of it, they can reveal astonishing facts and impress their audience and thereby their career.
So the contribution here is that a psychic or a medium has in some way developed her perceptions or his means of perceptions to be able to see into this astral, into the astral light, and to be able to know things about people who are asking him or her questions. So we have a question. Is that a sign of the wisdom of the medium? Yes.
Well,
consciousness of that individual has in previous lives dealt in that field so that it can be almost automatic for them. But I don't know if you call it wisdom because sometimes they don't get the story right, in other words.
So the contribution here is, well, the person certainly has the talents or the faculties involved, and they might evolved, and they might have been evolved because of work done in a previous life, whatever kind of work that might have been. But whether or not it's wisdom is questionable. We think an analogy perhaps would be, well, if we picked up a textbook in a subject that we've never studied before, read the first page, and then looked in the back of the book for the answers to the questions, is that wisdom? No, that's just looking up the answers because we know that the answers are in the back of the book. So when we're talking about psychics who have the talent to look into the astral, it may not necessarily be spiritual work, nor might it be even the wisest thing to do to engage with them. Anyone else? Yes.
The word wisdom is kind of, you know, puts a different spin, a different perspective on, we think, the question, because it does take wisdom over the course of time to progress to the point where a person would have these powers, but be able to do it with knowledge. And that knowledge would come from the wisdom that they had gleaned over the years and the progress that they had made spiritually over the years. But a regular medium that doesn't have that wisdom, that knowledge, is putting themselves in danger because they're not doing it with knowledge. They can't control it like a person who is more advanced would. They can, you know, we know that they make themselves sick over the course of time because they can't control it and it uses up the form's energy. So we think the idea of wisdom would come over time, and as we said, it brings forth those talents from a past life as well, for both the person with the wisdom and the person who is just
So the contribution here is, well, just because there are these faculties developed, it's probably not a sign of wisdom. If we consider the idea, you know, there's a difference obviously between knowledge and wisdom. Wisdom being the right application of principles, you know, knowledge is just knowing how to do it. So by definition, if a medium is going to passively open herself up or himself up and peer into this astral light, what kind of dangers does it put that medium in? That's one question. And another question is, you know, do we have the wisdom to be able to answer the questions, perhaps, of a grieving friend who misses Aunt Sally? Well, if they don't have the talents to understand that, who are we to know that it's the right thing to help them to know that, especially if we're not sure ourselves? So let's put that differently. Answers to the great questions in life, such as losing Aunt Sally, are probably answered better through the individual's own contemplation, through the individual's own meditation, rather than getting an answer from a medium. If someone goes to get an answer from someone who probably really does know and can answer accurately, well, then that person probably has the wisdom to know not to answer the question, because you're just depriving the individual of the gains that they would make if they contemplated and tried to think through it for themselves. Yes? Is there any other creature in the entire world who can say, I am?
Yeah.
Any contributions? Yes?
Well, of course, those who have gone beyond the human limitations. So we're the student aspect of those who are the geniuses. But we wanted to say, if seeing into the astral led to wisdom, then we should have had many, many mediums who would then be considered sages, and they never are. They either fade out or they get very estranged from even common sense.
Thank you. So then from this block so far, what we're concluding is that there's something going on as regards the astral, which theosophy teaches is important to know and to understand, but is probably more important to know not to play with it. So, yes?
There's one thing that I find that is very compelling in the third paragraph there. It says that this includes a statement that each thought, as well as word and act, make an image there. Are we conscious of that? It seems to indicate further on that the Mahatmas and the Adepts seem to be very aware that they are creating images with their thinking. But for most of us as humanity, I don't think we're aware that all the thoughts that we think are creating images that we're going to eventually have to incarnate through.
So the contribution here is perhaps we should think more about what we're saying and what we're doing, especially, you know, these images created by just the way that we think, which most of us would really not even reflect on the next day. However, the plane of thought is the real plane of action. So says the Bhagavad Gita. And if that's the case, then whatever's going on in that plane of thought is either as real as what's going on physically, or perhaps even more real. So what are we peopling our surroundings with? What kind of ideas and thoughts are we peopling? Is something we should be contemplating and conscious of? Yes?
But we're also told that things that come into our consciousness, like a bubble of a thought, has no permanent place in us. It's passing through. It's only what we focus on. And if we'd stop focusing on the negative in our lives and looked instead to the positive behind that, we'd be moving more quickly.
Thank you. Actually, yes, Mr. Judge talks about how each human being is responsible for every thought that he thinks. Isn't that interesting? And he also says that thoughts will come into our minds that we haven't necessarily generated. So then it probably makes sense in the effort to right thinking and right action, to dismiss certain ideas consciously and to what? To change our mind. In what direction? Okay, let's pick up in the second part. We'll pick up with the very next sentence, hence also.
At the top of page 2, hence also, the identity of deceased persons who are supposed to report especially out of this plane is not to be concluded from the giving of forgotten or unknown words, facts, or ideas. Out of this plane of matter can be taken the pictures of all who have ever lived, and then reflected on a suitable magneto-electrical surface, so as to seem like the apparition of the deceased, producing all the sensations of weight, hardness, and extension. Through the means of the astral light and the help of the elementals, the various material elements may be drawn down and precipitated from the atmosphere upon either a plane surface or in the form of a solid object. This precipitation may be made permanent or it may be of such a light, cohesive power as soon to fade away. But the help of the elementals can only be obtained by a strong will added to a complete knowledge of the laws which govern the being or the elementals. It is useless to give further details on this point. First, because the untrained student cannot understand. And second, a complete explanation is not permitted, were it even possible in this space.
Thank you.
There's the footnote on Acacia, which we read on the first page. Acacia is the infinite, impartite, intangible. Acacia in the mysticism of the esoteric philosophy is, properly speaking, a female Holy Ghost. Sound, or speech, being the logos, the manifested verbal of the unmanifested mother. See Shankaracharya, preface, page 33.
Thank you. Insights to this? Yes.
Many religions, but what comes to mind is perhaps being the most prevalent in their rituals, voodoo. Their whole thing is to propitiate the elementals, and isn't it not? I mean, it's they're dabbling in this realm, and it's without knowledge. So it's very dangerous indeed, and also blind belief makes it very effective because people get this gushing emotional attachment, and they blindly believe that such and such will come to pass, and it does because of the will. It does, but it's ignorance, which is very dangerous.
So the contribution here has to do with first, you know, voodoo and their practices done without knowledge, and we would say probably done without spiritual knowledge, because we wonder if it's the case that they do know how to manipulate the elementals, and we think that the same goes with witchcraft. So it's more so without spiritual knowledge, and so this is the same realm that they're playing in. If they had the real knowledge, they'd recognize that the control of elementals, which is done apparently through use of sound and color and thought and will, had really best not be dabbled with, because the effects, the karmic effects to the individual who's ignorantly dabbling with it can be catastrophic, and you don't know how you're hurting the other individual with this voodoo. So that back to back with blind belief in false ideas speaks to people not really appreciating or understanding the impact that thought has on the astral. And the people, we are literally swimming in this astral light, in this astral light of a vibration of false ideas in this Western world. Yes?
Well, it seems, I think we get a hint there on the first reading there. It says that the adepts only make pictures that are in accordance with divine law. So what is divine law? It's obviously not the practice of the voodoo or the psychic or anyone who wants to get something. But how can we understand what it means by divine law?
Well, so the question, the contribution here is, you know, the adept who really does understand this and uses it consistent with divine law for the purposes of spiritual evolution of humanity, of the race of mankind, that's one thing. Now, how can we understand the difference between what he's doing, which is consistent with divine law, and anything else? Well, that's the great question. A, if we don't know the answer to that question, we probably better not be dabbling it. And B, you know, the student of theosophy puts what? You know, ethics, virtue, morality, self-contemplation, you know, take yourself out and observe how you're affecting the world around you just by being, you know, real in the world around us. We're told that really that's the first step in coming to know some of these higher, the answer to these higher questions, is if we set certain causes within our own nature, which can only be set moving by living a virtuous life, then those other kind of answers, you know, other answers will come. We may read the same book for 10 years and not see something in it until the 11th year that just clicks, like, you know, like the combination and the tumblers of a lock that has been there for so long and suddenly click and it opens because we were ready for it. So prepare ourselves not to be given the knowledge, but to be ready for the knowledge should it be given to us. And then there was in the yellow. Was your hand up?
Yeah. So you're speaking in terms of if you want something, you have to surrender to it. That if you want this knowledge, you have to give up everything else. Is, you know, I mean, we're talking on a mental plane. It comes down to a feeling of ultimate selflessness. You know, we live in a world of selfishness right now. To be unselfish, the endeavor, but to be truly selfless is to really know yourself and the world.
Thank you. So then, as was said, leading a life of virtue, which very simply is a life of moral courage. That's what virtue is. The willingness to do the right thing because it's there to be done without expecting anything in return, even if it makes you not part of the crowd, but if you know it's there to be done. There's a sacrifice there. Sometimes it's a sacrifice of one's own ego. Sometimes it's a sacrifice of things that we may be emotionally attached to. It could be even a sacrifice of certain friendships sometimes. And it would seem, though, that the lower is going to have to sacrifice in order to move from wherever it is on this continuum of selfishness through unselfishness through selflessness. It's a sacrifice all along the way, it would seem. So we'll pick up, yes, is there a hand here?
So it reminded me of Janice's article about the telltale picture gallery, the precipitation of the images, where he was instructed on the operation of the astral light, showing the images of all the disciples. And that seemed to have been records, astral records, which were created by the elementals in the cave that you were shown by the master. Do you remember the story?
Yes.
And it showed the state of each of the disciples who were cellos in the school. And then the elementals would scavenge up the ones who had dropped out of sight, fallen by the wayside. That seems like Judge was writing from personal experience of being shown how this law could be brought into operation.
Yes, and actually what he says along that line is when he was brought into that realm, the realm of the elementals, the physical world, he knew it was still there, but that was hazy and vague, and the elemental world was his reality at the time. A very interesting idea. The flip side is our, you know, typically how we live our lives. It's important if we are students of the philosophy to understand in certain ways, you know, well, how do we impact the astral? Well, the way it happens, it's not just, you know, it's not a miracle. There are processes. And the elementals, which are metaphysical yet very real lives that in certain ways have a consciousness of their own, according and exist on in all different classes, on all different levels, it is they who we impact with our thoughts. And the strength with which we speak, the strength with which we think, sets certain things in motions on that plane, the effects of which at our stage of the game we don't know, but the effects of which at an adept stage of the game he fully knows. He fully knows the dynamics of that, which is why it's said that an adept actually, he never takes action until he can see the effect of that action in the mind of another adept. Isn't that interesting? That's how conscious, how important it is to be conscious of what we're saying. We're gonna step forward into the third and final part, and then we can get back into everything. Please.
World of the elementals.
Right, so we're starting with the world of the elementals. It's four paragraphs before the end. The world of the elementals, please.
The world of the elementals is an important factor in our world and in the course of the student. Each thought, as it is evolved by man, coalesces instantly with an elemental and is then beyond the man's power. It can easily be seen that this process is going on every instant. Therefore, each thought exists as an entity. Its length of life depends on two things. A, the original force of the person's will and thought. B, the power of the elemental which coalesced with it, the latter being determined by the class to which the elemental being, to which the elemental belongs. This is the case with good and bad thoughts alike, and as the will beneath the generality of wicked thoughts is usually powerful, we can see that the result is very important because the elemental has no conscience and obtains its constitution and direction from the thought it may from time to time carry. Each human being has its own elementals that partake of his nature and his thoughts. If you fix your thoughts upon a person in anger or in critical, uncharitable judgment, you attract to yourself a number of those elementals that belong to, generate, and are generated by this particular thought or family, and they participate themselves. And they precipitate themselves upon you. Hence, through the injustice of your merely human condemnation, which cannot know the source and causes of the action of another, you at once become a sharer of his fault or failing by your own act, and the spirit expelled returns with seven devils worse than himself. This is the origin of the popular saying that, quote, curses like chickens come home to roost, unquote, and has its root in the laws governing magnetic affinity.
Yes.
So this afterlife is magnetic. It is it's of a different state of consciousness. It has a different material that is not that is relevant to that state of consciousness. So, since we're not in that state of consciousness, apparently we need to know that the effect occurred.
So the contribution here is there's something about the astral which is different depending on a state of consciousness. Yet, when we talk about the astral, let's remember that isn't it an infinite series of grades of astral going from the lowest dregs to the highest, most ethereal Akasha? So these different degrees or these grades of this principle, this is one principle, Akasha being the highest, the astral being the lowest, are two aspects of the same principle. And that principle corresponds directly to a principle within the human being, which is the mind. So the mind is if passive, can be influenced by even our lower nature, the desires, or if active and conscious, can turn itself toward the higher, toward buddhi, toward wisdom. So when we think of the astral, we have to realize that everything that is in the astral has its correspondence to within our nature. And it's probably, if we want to learn something about the astral light, it would be a good idea to pick up a study of one's self and a study of the mind, because everything that goes on in our mind is either reflected in or is a reflection from the astral light. Yes?
Well, this reading, we found anyway, that this reading on the elementals and how they can affect us, how they basically, once you think it, it's there, it never goes away, is rather kind of scary in a way. Because if you just happen to think about, you know, just as some really simple thought is like, oh, you know, what a stupid thing he did. And not anything really serious, but it's there and it's colored, and you're kind of stuck with it forever. And how do you change? I mean, we all have negative thoughts about people, and sometimes they can be really angry thoughts about people. I mean, how do you control that?
Right, so how do we control, if there's such seemingly infinite potential to mess up along the way, that sounds like it's not fair. Well, certainly, if you remember, sometimes Mr. Judge talks about, you know, depending on how much force you put into it, they pop, like soap bubbles, just pff, let it go, right? But also... a lot of them don't, right? And in our living our life, now, as we said, the Mahatma, the adept in thought, knows the effect and the extent to which it's going to go. We don't. However, what we can know, even if we're making mistakes, when we have that thought, if we keep a check on our motive, it's our emotion, you know, with every thought, there's a corresponding emotion that is impressed upon this elemental. When our motive is right, when it's a high motive, and the mistake goes out, the karma of that is completely different if it were a lower selfish motive. So it would seem the check is not to worry about what's going on out there so much, even though we know we're responsible for it, but to bear in mind what's going on in here and to be self-conscious of that, to be sit in the closet and be self-conscious before, you know, before we engage and get excited about things. Yes?
Well, we think we read in philosophy, regret nothing. Regret nothing. And you can only live in the now. You can't live in the past, and you can't live in the future. So regret nothing, and just keep on moving forward.
Regret nothing.
As best you can.
Keep on moving forward as best you can. And, you know, there's that saying, you know, right motive will get you to Devakan. Wisdom will get you to union with the Supreme. So theosophy actually gives us this universal basis of thought, these universal principles that we can take steps forward in gaining control of ourselves so that we're setting up causes for the world around us and for the future. good motive is always good. But Mr. Crosby would say, you know, actually, he would say, you know, good motive is for naught if your thinking's wrong. That's what theosophy is for. But Judge would say, well, right motive will get you to Devakan, but right thinking will get you to wisdom with the union with the Supreme. We thought that. Yes.
What does it mean? Have faith, hope, and charity, the greatest of these is charity.
Faith, hope, and charity, the greatest of these is charity. Well, rather than spending the rest of the hour on that, because we could spend days on it, let's look directly to charity, it would seem, probably. We don't know if that's a personal opinion. But charity, we think, is directly related to compassion. Having charity for another person really is not, it's not a personal act. It's not an emotional act. Some people think that we'll say compassion is an emotional thing. No, the student of theosophy sees compassion as a power of the soul. It is a sister power, could we say, just along that line, we don't know specifically, but sister power to will, you know, compassion and will and intuition, there's something that they all have in common. So to have compassion, to have charity, is to make the effort to put oneself into the shoes of another person, not for the sake of feeling what they're feeling, but for the sake of, if I can know more clearly, because really I've probably experienced that in my past, then I can also know maybe I can make a contribution in helping them to overcome the challenges that they're going through right now. Hence we have charity. Yes, Cindy Ellen?
Perhaps another way of looking at it is sacrifice. What are we willing to sacrifice? Our time, our money, our attention, our minutes in the day. So what are we willing to sacrifice for another? So you know, that's charity.
So charity is what we are willing to sacrifice for another. Thank you. Yes?
Well, since our talk this morning is on this idea of the astral life, it seems that what we learn to do is to be better able to help others, not betray yourself, because in the presence of what we hear or what sense or feel, what comes to mind is that word, if I be lifted up out of the water, for all men to eat. So it would seem to hear we learn to be a benefit, self-control, and then we're on the road to assuming responsibility for the weaknesses of others.
Thank you. So in this contribution, we heard lift ourselves out of the mud. We heard to be the better able to help others and taking responsibility. So from the theosophical perspective, that is right along the line of raise oneself by the self, which can never be done without right motive. The only motive that it has to be there is in service to others, to be the better able to help and teach others. Thank you. Yes?
The first full paragraph on page 21, we think is just an amazing paragraph, and that it's really not emphasized that much. And generally, we don't hear it emphasized. Of course, we don't talk about elementals in general that much either, but by merely thinking of others, by mere human condemnation, then we can attract those elementals to others. So, and then we become a sharer in the fault or failing of the others. So we think two things. One is that thoughts are things, and this is really a powerful demonstration of that, and that we are all one. That we're all sharing this, and we can attract it to us in a heartbeat. And so we should be ceaselessly thinking about this, that, you know, just to not condemn others, to be charitable. You know, for no other reason than the selfish, that it'll draw, you know, we go from selfish to, you know, we progress.
Yes.
But even from a selfish aspect, we don't want this. We don't want that.
I don't want to do that.
No.
So, well, and isn't that just the flip side of what we were talking about? We were talking about earlier, you know, compassion and charity, which is the ability to see the challenge of another, put oneself in the shoes, know what's necessary to do to help them climb themselves out of it, not to fix it for them, to help them climb themselves out of it. And the flip side of that would be condemnation, seeing the challenges and the problems of another, judging it, and there's something about, you know, judge not that ye may be judged. There's something about judging. It's almost like maybe putting yourself in the same, maybe it's because we're putting ourselves in the same place in the astral light with that judgment, recognizing it, being conscious of it, and that's apparently a magnetic affinity for the very elementals that are creating the challenges for our brother or sister. So, you know, these ideas, compare, contrast, there's no dogma here. Nobody's expected to believe anything. We talk about metaphysics a lot, and this is a pretty metaphysical discussion, but we try to base it on universal principles, so when we leave, we have something to think through and apply, in particular, to our own lives as we see fit. Yes?
You recall that you don't know about today.
Please speak louder. No, start all over. Please speak louder.
Its effect. They may not get it now, but later on in life they'll find there's something about classical music that's encouraging. It's sound. Why would those sounds have the power to lift rather than downcast?
Well, so what is it about classical music that those sounds have the power to lift rather than downcast? Well, you know, isn't it, you know, didn't Pythagoras have something to say about that? Wasn't he one to say that the power of music has the power to heal? And that it's all about right harmonies, right proportion, right correspondences. Well, as respects the Akasha, its sole production is sound. Isn't that what the Bard says? Its sole production is sound, and that the, you know, the whole, there's another statement, something along the lines, the whole series of sounds emanate from the Akasha. But it would seem by definition they would do so under the laws of harmony. And so when we surround ourselves with, this is one of the ideas, when we surround ourselves with harmony in color, in sound, architecture, everything, the effect that that has actually on our nature is to, it calms kama, it calms our lower nature. That's food. Art is food for kama, just as thought is food for the mind. Are we going to eat salad or donuts every day, right? The effect of this, you know, it's said in ancient Greece that women in certain classes would always be surrounded when they were pregnant with beauty and art because of the effect that it had on the developing fetus. Yeah.
So the opposite then, there's music out there that almost like eviscerates you. You know, it just, you know, you make you grit your teeth and like, ah. So that would kind of be like the lower part of the astral then that would come. Would that be in what they call the dregs of the astral, the lower part? Because that certainly wouldn't come from the Akasha.
It's right. It's a matter of harmony and proportion, or disharmony and in proportion, if that's a word. It's a matter of, you know, concert or disconcertedness, and people have their preferences, and that's all personal. But what we're speaking to is, under the law, there are certain proportions and harmonies that follow patterns, and those patterns are set actually at the highest levels. You know, we talk about Dion Schohans, which are very simply in the today's parlance, the archangels, seven classes of them, all of which correspond to the seven notes of the scale and the seven colors of the rainbow, and the harmony and proportion which emanates from the highest is part and parcel to the host of Dion Chohans, or the host of angels, which are the creators, so to speak, which are the builders of the universe. The universe is built, what? Plato says that God geometrizes, which means the universe is built according to the laws of geometry. And so it makes sense to make a personal effort, maybe if one feels so inclined, to learn more about these laws of harmony in art and music. Yes?
Well, so we, because we have speech, we can create that verbum, that sound. We are, it's just another evidence that we are the creators of this world in which we live. Now, if our thoughts and our actions affect the astral in such a deep way, you know, the words we speak, you know, may attract those elementals to us and all those influences that are associated with that kind of speech. So that's why we try to form an association of like-minded students so that we can talk about these ideas and sort of elevate ourselves and those around us to a higher understanding.
Thank you for the contribution. Very nicely said. Yes?
I was just going to offer in regards to sound. And I don't remember where I read it, but it was some tribe in another area of the world. The way they would fell a tree is they would all gather around and yell at it, and then eventually it died.
Wow.
I thought that was just fascinating that they could kill the tree by yelling at it. And I don't remember what tribe that is.
Amazing.
It is amazing. So harmony and disharmony.
Yeah, very interesting. Yes.
Yeah.
The woodpecker tribe.
It's the woodpecker tribe. Yes.
And the fact that in these rooms, it was our first time and we hear the sound of the Gita, read the Gita, which is a song, so to speak, that makes an impression at the time. We have to repeat it, and then we notice. So it goes back to our previous comment that we need not worry, we need not get upset over what we may hear if we have answers. That requires contemplation, concentration, and meditation. These words begin to have meaning to us. Words, sounds, so forth. And we learn to lay back in this area, study, and hope for the best. have to learn how to pass along to others.
So the contribution here has to do with concentration, meditation, contemplation, and which in a nutshell is pulling ourselves back from our emotional nature, from kama. When our mind is so affected by the emotional nature, when it, you know, in the typical workaday world, the very nature of it is oscillation. It's constant. It's back and forth. And when the Gita talks about, you know, he who is fixed in contemplation, one reference we read, it really made sense. It said, you know, if you take that word fixed in contemplation and just replace that with one who is at home in contemplation, can stand back and look at what might be emotional distresses and act anyway, or make certain decisions regardless, knowing that with faith and hope that the outcome will be very different than if he allowed his lower nature to so influence and to keep him off balance, right? Yes.
Is not that the challenge of life? Is, are we to ride this horse through life, and who's leading us on? The horse? Or are we telling the horse where to go? And oftentimes, that's the only the beginning of our search. We can control our lower so that we can aid them.
So we are riding this horse through life. Let's remember we're studying a philosophy that involves the recognition that we are not this body, that we're using this body for now, that we are immortal souls, that we use many bodies from life to life. And the bodies that we create for ourselves are a reflection not of the moment, but the physical bodies we have today are a reflection of our thoughts and actions and emotions in the past. So whatever we have going on are lessons to be learned from previous experiences. It's what we're experiencing on this plane right now does not point to our character development. There are plenty of us who are far advanced in the sense that may have incredible disabilities and yet are further advanced along the path, and the very reason that they have such disabilities are what? Because their character is of a nature that is so strong that they are prepared in this lifetime to see themselves through greater and greater problems than they could ever see themselves at a time when they were of weaker character. So we take responsibility for what's going on. We set up certain causes, the effect of which, of course, is in the world around us, but it's also very much in the future waiting for us to harvest in the form of family, fellow students, friends, right down to these physical vehicles that we live in and use. So let's bear that in mind. So with that, we're going to close the meeting. And we hope to see you Wednesday evening for our study of the Bhagavad Gita.